Welcome to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. I'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to HearstRanch.com. On Taproots, we dig deep to explore America's growing local food movement and to connect local family farmers, chefs, and foodies together and to you, our listeners. Taproots will air at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first Monday of the month. We'll cover topics like eating and cooking seasonally, how to strengthen our local food economies community by community, how to grow and raise more of your own food, and who's out there making a difference in paving the way to a more sustainable and thoughtful way of living and eating on the planet. And please send me your ideas of what you'd like to hear more about or people you'd like to hear on my show. You may email me at marla@edibleaustin.com. Well, today we're lucky to have two women in the studio who are truly making a difference in the way we shop, cook, and eat food, and who show us in their recent books how what and how we eat has a powerful effect on our ecosystems and our sustainable future. First, we'll talk with Luisa Shafia, whose recent book, Lucid Food, takes us on an eco-friendly shopping and cooking adventure. Then we'll talk with Anna LaPay about her just-released book, Diet for a Hot Planet, where she connects the dots between global food production, the food choices we make, and climate change. And then we'll have a conversation with both Luisa and Anna about the ways that you can make a positive difference. We'll be right back. I'm your coal man. I got strawberry. Good-looking ears of corn. I got the homemade drink. Praline soup.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. My first guest is Luisa Shafia, who works as a chef, caterer, educator, and food writer with Lucid Food, her eco-friendly food consultancy based in New York City. Her new book, by the same name, is just out. Welcome to the show, Luisa.
Hi, Marla. Great to be here.
Luisa, your book, Lucid Food, while it has over 90 seasonal recipes and beautiful photographs, is more than just a cookbook. Can you tell us what inspired you to write this book and how you organized it for the shopper and the cook?
Sure. Well, the book really came directly out of my catering company, Lucid Food. I was doing things like composting all our vegetable scraps in the kitchen, trying to do the events as low waste as possible so, you know, we didn't end up with large bags of trash at the end of parties. And at the same time, we were buying from local farmers and making really beautiful food. And people seemed thrilled that you could have this great food, you know, at high-end cocktail parties, but know that you were doing it the right way, that it was all eco-friendly. And people seemed really surprised that these things could happen, you know, simultaneously. So I thought, I think I have something to share with people. So that's really where the idea of the book came from. And then I wanted to include a lot of useful information and a lot of the things that have sort of led me to feel the way that I do about food, you know, just about feeling like I want to shop in a way that supports local farmers and all that. But I wanted to try and do it without being too overbearing. So we organized the book so that some of those information pieces are in between the recipes, so you don't have to get through a whole long sort of academic essay before you get to all the good stuff. It's all kind of mixed in.
That's great. And so what is Lucid Food? I mean, it's such a compelling name, and wondering if you can talk a little bit about what does lucid food mean to you?
Sure. To me, it basically means transparent, nothing hidden, purity in your food. And for me, that really means you see where it came from, you see the journey that the food took in getting to your table, and there's nothing hidden and mysterious. There's no chemicals, and there's also no unknown aspects of the food, like, I have no idea what the labor conditions were where this was grown, or I hope this place doesn't have really, really terrible farming practices that are destroying the land over time. It's trying to buy from a source that you understand and know, so that you really understand what you're eating and you're making a conscious choice when you buy your food.
And what goes along with that also is that it's in season.
Yes, absolutely. For me, I feel like it's just more fun to shop with the seasons, but it also turns out to be more eco-friendly because your food has to travel a smaller distance. But one of the things that I've really tried to make clear in my book is that I feel like eating with the seasons, eating locally, it's actually really embraces all of the treasures that nature has to offer us at different times of year. It doesn't mean denying yourself or your family or whoever you're cooking for of treats that you love. It's really embracing these wonderful things, like pomegranates, come through in winter. Persimmons, just come through for a few weeks in late fall. Things like right now we have garlic ramps, fiddlehead ferns. It's just so fun to cook with them. If you had them all year round, it might not be as exciting. But I just think it gives you, there are always surprises around the corner when you go food shopping, when you try and shop locally. And for me, it's really about the sensuality of food, making food with bright colors, bold tastes, not a whole lot of seasoning, not really masking what's there, but really kind of bringing out what's there in the natural flavors of the food. And so I feel like that's sort of my way of bringing people over to my way of thinking, is by giving them wonderful, beautiful, easy recipes to make good, tasty food.
Well, and there's also a wonderful theme that kind of goes through the book about building community and social, having fun and really enjoying food with people. And you start the book off with an interesting story about an experience you had in New York that kind of gave you pause. And I wondered if you could tell us that story.
Oh, sure. I'd love to. It's funny. I mean, we're here in the studio not far from where I was during the blackout. I guess it was... a few years ago, we had a huge blackout that started and it wound up being statewide. And I was on a subway on my way into Manhattan from Brooklyn. Luckily, we hadn't left the station, so the subway came to a screeching halt. Everybody had to get out. And when we got upstairs, we found out, hey, there's no electricity anywhere. Computers are down. This is kind of a big crisis. So I went over to what's sort of the main strip in this neighborhood, Bedford Avenue, and I called on a friend of mine who was nearby, and I had to yell up to his window because phones weren't working. Luckily, he was home. It felt very old-fashioned. And we walked around, and everyone was out on the streets. Restaurants were serving food. When it got dark, people were cooking over, fires and grills. There was, cold beer and tubs of ice. And it was a wonderful feeling. It was one of my best nights in New York. And I felt like it was because everyone was really forced together. It's so easy to isolate yourself in your apartment with the internet and just, not talk to anyone. And of course, technology has been wonderful and it has allowed us to do so many things. But I think in some ways it's made us lose touch with what's important, which really is community in the long run. That's connecting with other people is what gives you a deep sense of satisfaction. So I really talk in the book about different ways to share meals with people that aren't just about going to eat in a restaurant. Having potlucks, having monthly get-togethers where there's some kind of theme about food. Just cooking more, making food from scratch. Yes, we save time when we, go out to eat or when we buy processed food that's all ready to go. But in the long run, you don't get as much satisfaction out of it. And I hate to sound, preachy or elitist. I know people are pressed for time. I certainly am. However, what we've been finding in recent years is that there are major health costs to the way that we've been eating by cutting corners, by trying to save time. And we've really lost a sense of where our food comes from, to the point where these days there are so many food scares, food that's been mass produced in a factory, somewhere across the country. It gets out and no one even understands where the food originated until many people have been sickened. So it's just getting that sense of control over where your food comes from again. I feel like in the end, it will give you a greater sense of satisfaction.
And I think that's something that we're all finding out as we do more of our own cooking and shopping at farmers markets and getting to know the people that sell and make and grow the food. One of my favorite recipes in your book is, and it's appropriate because it's a spring recipe, which is apropos to now. And also, it's also one of your most beautiful recipes. And I have to say how attractive and gorgeous and compelling the photography is in your book, and just looking at the pictures makes you want to cook the recipes, which I happen to love that. So the recipe is rhubarb and pistachios over thick yogurt.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that one
and
up.
I love it because first it's a simple recipe, and I'm wondering if you could give our listeners a taste of this and maybe tell us how to make it.
Oh, sure. It's really easy. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that one up because just actually developing this recipe really made me fall in love with rhubarb. And I love it for a few different reasons. One is because it has such a beautiful natural color. There just aren't that many different ingredients that you can cook with that are naturally bright pink. There's a lot of processed ingredients that are bright pink, but this one's totally natural. I love it for that. It's also got a wonderful sour sweetness that's a great complement to fatty ingredients, which is why I have it paired with thick yogurt and nuts. And also it's something that's really an inexpensive product. A lot of it grows. Anyone that I know that has rhubarb growing on their property, they, every spring they say, it's growing out of control, please come take some. So, it's an economical ingredient to cook with. But this recipe is really easy. You just basically slice up the rhubarb into big fat chunks, throw them in a pot with just enough water to get them cooking because they contain so much water naturally. You don't need to add a whole lot. Plus, you want the finished rhubarb at the end to be pretty thick. So you just add a little bit of water, put the lid on, get the rhubarb simmering, and in about 7 minutes, it's all nice and soft and mushy. You'll probably have to stick a wooden spoon in there and mush it up a little bit yourself. But then you let that cool and stir in just a few spices, some cardamom, nutmeg, a little bit of salt, which actually brings out the sweetness and brightens the flavor. I know it sounds weird to add salt to a dessert, but the salt is key. A little bit of light colored honey, just enough to sweeten it. And it's important to use a light color so you don't darken that gorgeous pink of the rhubarb.
And a local honey, if you can.
And a local honey, that's right. And that gives me an excuse to say that here in New York, in New York City, they just legalized beekeeping. So we'll have a lot of very, very local honey around here. Is it in Austin?
It is. It is. And there's a new urban beekeeping group that just started up in Austin to help people figure out how to grow bees in their backyard.
Oh, that's so great. Okay, so a little honey, some vanilla, and then a little bit of rose water extract, just a little, because you don't want the whole mixture to taste like a sock drawer, which will happen if you put too much of that in. So you let that all cool, and then you just serve it over some nice, thick Greek-style yogurt. And then I like to add some toasted, chopped pistachios. So at the end, you have a beautiful pink, green, and white dessert that's very, very easy on you and very impressive to guests, I have to say.
And if you're lucky enough to live where you can buy raw milk and make your own yogurt, That's an even better way to do it, too.
Oh, and yes,
then
absolutely.
It's really yummy. So one other, as long as we're talking food for a minute or two here, another favorite piece in your book is your short story about making pizza. And it's appropriate because we're here at Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn in the studio. And all the toppings that you can create for your pizza from recipes in the book. So it's sort of like a reuse and recycle angle that I picked up on in the book that was kind of cool. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Oh, sure. You mean just about how fun and simple it is to make grilled pizza in the summertime?
And what you can do with toppings and how you can take leftovers and or things that you make out of the book. Actually got a lot of recipes in here that adapt really well to a pizza topping.
Oh, okay, great. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, because I think sometimes people think, oh, pizza, there's a certain formula that I have to follow. But really, you can do whatever you want with pizza, especially when you're making it yourself. So there's a bunch of recipes in the book that make great toppings, and maybe they'll give the listeners some ideas of what you can put on. Some of my suggestions are stinging nettle pesto. So any kind of pesto works great on top of pizza. Eggplant dip. So, you know, if you have some baba ganoush lying around, or if you buy this book and you make that recipe, that's a great one. Potatoes on pizza. That's something that you see all the time in Italy. So I suggest there's a watercress mashed potatoes recipe in here, and I love that on top of pizza. It's also colorful. You can do grilled chicken on top of there. Grilled maitake mushrooms or any kind of mushroom. Beans, baby artichokes. Sautéed leafy greens. And I should say the best way to do it is to pre-cook your toppings. You know, say you want to make, you know, some sautéed garlicky kale. Make that, and then when you're grilling your pizza, just for the last few minutes after you've flipped it over onto the second side, put on your already cooked toppings. And it works beautifully. But you don't want to try and actually cook them while they're on the pizza because it won't work.
Thanks, Luisa. And you can find recipes like this in Luisa's new book, Lucid Food. Luisa, is there a website that they can go to find out more about your book?
Yes, they can go to lucidfood.com. And I have a food blog on there with new recipes that I come up with and just sort of interesting tidbits. And please come visit me there and leave comments.
I also want to say we're going to be doing a couple of book giveaways after the show. One, we're going to give away Luisa's Lucid Food book, and then we'll also give away a copy of Anna LaPay's Diet for a Hot Planet. And to receive these books, what you need to do is to email me at marla@ediblestin.com and give us some eco tips that you use when you're cooking or shopping that you'd like to share with our listeners, and we'll tell people on the next show. So thank you, Luisa. We'll talk more in a little bit. We're going to take a short break now and be back with our next guest, Anna LaPay.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go? What you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise and put up a parking lot. They took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people $1.50 to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise and put up a parking lot.
Well, welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. My next guest is Anna LaPay, whose newest book, Diet for a Hot Planet, just hit the streets. Anna was named one of Time Magazine's Eco Who's Who and is a founding principal of Small Planet Fund. She's also authored several books, including the best-selling Hope's Edge, with her mother, Frances Moore LePay. She's a frequent commentator on television and radio, and we're very excited to have her here in the studio to talk with us today. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Anna, in this new book of yours, you make the disturbing connection between conventional food production and global warming. In your introduction, you say, "Move over, Hummer. Say hello to hamburger." Can you run this down for us?
Sure. So, actually, I tend to not use the term conventional food only because when we think of convention, we think of something that's been around for a really long time. But actually, when you think about the way in which we produce food, we trade food, the way we process our foods, it's actually just a blink of historic eye that we've started creating food in this way. So I talk about the industrial food chain, and I pulled together in this book a lot of studies that have been written that have really been tracing what are the emissions that we can trace back to food. And when you add it all up, when you add up all of the emissions that come from the livestock sector, from our decision to create a highly industrialized, highly wasteful, not to mention animal welfare and human welfare issues, but highly wasteful and destructive factory feedlot system. When you add that up, when you add up all of the synthetic fertilizer and emissions from using those fertilizers, when you add up the waste coming out of the food chain, we in the U.S., we waste about half the food that we could be eating. It gets wasted, ends up in landfills. Add all of that up and much more. You get to about one third of all global emissions are coming from the food chain indirectly or directly. So one third, that's pretty significant. And there are some estimates that show that livestock alone is emitting more or as much emissions as the entire transport sector. So thus the little quip about the Hummer and the hamburger.
And also you compare nature-based agroecological practices to the chemical dependence of industrialized ag. What makes this direction more sustainable than the other?
So yeah, so in the book I contrast what I call climate destructive agriculture or farming with climate friendly farming or farming that actually works with nature and not sort of against it. And fundamentally it's this totally opposite worldview and totally opposite idea about how we should be growing food. And on the one hand, you have this industrial mindset and an industrial model that just really in the past 100 years has taken hold now going global that says, look, we are going to conquer nature. We're going to fight against pests. We're going to fight against weeds. We're going to create artificial soil fertility. And how are we going to do it? We're going to do it with an addiction, essentially, to fossil fuels through synthetic fertilizer, which takes 33,000 cubic feet of natural gas to produce 1 ton of synthetic fertilizer. We're going to do it through toxic chemicals that are all petroleum-based in order to fight those weeds and fight those pests. And we're going to do it through getting animals off the land and stuffing them into feedlots where they're raised on diets that are filled with pharmaceutical drugs and antibiotics and fed with feed that's been raised, again, with those synthetic fertilizers and chemicals. And it's essentially a very, very, very short-sighted idea about how to produce our food. And it's short-sighted in multiple ways. It's short-sighted economically. Ultimately, this is hurting us economically. It's ruined our rural communities. It's hurting us in terms of healthcare costs. And it's short-sighted in terms of the climate. It's making food a contributor to the crisis as opposed to food and agriculture are part of the solution to the crisis.
And one of my favorite chapters in the book is called Myth Informed, Answering the Critics. And this comes up so often. I know a lot of our listeners are definitely already on board with the idea of using organic and nature-based processes in farming and cooking and making food choices already. But we're often confronted with people, often there are people in the industry, and it's even in the mainstream media, that defend this industrialized food production and also their emphasis on biotechnology solutions to problems. So I was wondering if you could talk about what you list about, I think there's six of these myths in the book,
But the one I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about here is the hunger myth.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Or the question often asked is, can sustainable agriculture really feed the world?
Mm-hmm.
How would you answer this?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you brought this chapter up, because I see Diet for a Hot Planet as really part of a conversation that we're all having. And I feel that it's part of a conversation that was started 40 years ago in 1971 when my mother wrote her first book, Diet for a Small Planet. And this is really as much as I'm a child of my mother, this book is really a child of that book. And I feel like it's a conversation that folks like Eric Schlosser and Michael Pollan and Marian Nestle, that many of us are having. And what I keep coming up against as I have this conversation with people are these myths that, as you mentioned, that people are hearing, that we're hearing in the mainstream media, and that come back at us when we try to argue for why we want to have a sustainable food system and one that taps nature for its fertility and for all of the kinds of things that I just mentioned. And one of the strongest myths that I think is out there is this hunger scare, I call it. Because what other idea could more stop us in our tracks than hearing somebody say, oh, everything you're doing and talking about local foods, and oh, you folks at Edible Austin, all that, you know, it sounds really good, and that food, you know, sounds really tasty, and Louisa, those dishes sound really great, but we couldn't possibly feed the world this way. And all of you who are promoting this, not only are you Pollyanna to think we can, but you're callous, because you're actually essentially saying part of the world should starve so that you get to eat your delicious rhubarb dessert. And what I say in this book is that absolutely that is such a myth, and that the opposite is true. That if you look at what's happening in the world right now, today, with this industrial food system that's totally predicated on the bottom line of some of the biggest companies in the world, what you see is that it's actually pushing more people into hunger. That it's actually directly the root of so much hunger, where there's now more than 1 billion people are malnourished and not getting enough calories. And what I'm saying is that we actually, by shifting in a direction that's nature-based, that's better for the climate, that's producing this healthier food, that we know that doesn't mean sacrificing anybody's ability to feed themselves. And in fact, what it means is helping people and helping small-scale farmers be able to feed themselves better, be able to grow the food that's going to make them thrive. And those of us who are living in cities and supporting our small-scale farmers with these food choices, ensuring that we are fed well and that we aren't malnourished by eating calories that are essentially empty.
And also that our local food and developing our local food economies actually gives us more food security.
That's exactly right. And this is why these myths get me so riled up, because when you look at what we know will happen, even if we were successful in stopping all emissions today, we already know that we are on a path, just based on the emissions that we've already been responsible for, that we have already affected our climate. And what that means for sure is that we will have more droughts and more floods, that we will have more erratic weather, and we need more resilient farms, not less resilient. And what we have discovered is that sustainable farming methods, again, getting off of this short-sighted addiction to fossil fuels, that these sustainable agricultural methods are creating healthy soils. And what do healthy soils produce? They produce more resilient crops.
And also more varied crops. So biodiversity
Absolutely.
Is another really very important component to survival and survival of the planet, and also to help ease hunger problems around the world. And
that's exactly right.
I really think that, again, a lot of people don't get it. They think that it is elitist, or that mm-hmm. it's not taking into account the burgeoning populations everywhere where they need to be fed. But I think it's important to understand that corporations that often make this argument, their first goal is to satisfy their shareholders. Their goal is to make a profit. Their goal is not to feed the world, although they use that phrase a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. And therefore, how are they going to meet that goal? One of the ways is going to be expanding market share. So one of the chapters in the book is called The Shape of Things to Come. And I talk about what direction are we headed if we don't radically change how we're feeding the world. And in The Shape of Things to Come, I talk about what are the three drivers that are pushing us toward a food system that will be even more responsible for climate change. And one of those driving forces is really the growing dominance in the food chain of just a few companies we're talking about here, who are increasingly controlling not only so much of the food that we see in this country, but going global. And look, we already know, we in the U.S., we unfortunately are the guinea pigs for what this fast food industrial diet does. And it doesn't take a PhD in nutrition. It doesn't take being a doctor to know that we guinea pigs are doing really badly. By the last statistics I've seen, they're estimated 1 in 3 kids born in this country will develop diabetes at some point in their lifetime because of the food they eat. So we know that this diet is not one that will create a thriving planet. And unfortunately, it's our U.S.-based companies that are really promoting this all around the world.
And, you know, much has been written about the problems of commodity crops like corn and soybeans. But something new I learned from reading your book was the story behind palm oil. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that, because that's a great example of something that most people really don't know much about.
Sure. And what I try to do in the book, yes, is to, again, add into the conversation, but also to tell some stories that people haven't been hearing about that are underreported. And one of those is a story of palm. And palm oil, it's one of the most widely traded vegetable oils in the world now. If you've eaten pretty much anything processed in the grocery store, crackers and cakes and cookies and granola bars, you know, it probably has palm oil in it. If you start really looking at your ingredients label, I think you'd be surprised how much palm oil you actually consume. And most of the world's palm oil comes from just 2 countries, Indonesia and Malaysia. And most of the palm oil now being produced in those countries is being produced on massive plantations that have been created on former really, really carbon-rich lands. And as a result of these palm oil plantations, these 2 countries are now among the world's leading emissions, one of the world's leading emitters of greenhouse gases. And so in the book, I talk about how palm oil is just another element of the food chain and how it has impacted climate. But I also use palm oil in part of the hopeful part of the book, because the book tries to balance. This is definitely not a doom and gloom book about climate change, if you can believe it. I try to be very hopeful because I am very hopeful. And the palm oil story is ultimately a hopeful one, because I talk about the citizen groups that are really calling the biggest palm oil importers to task and saying, we as citizens don't want our food to be contributing to the climate crisis. And we expect you corporations to be stepping up and to be ensuring that your production is sustainable, not destructive.
Well, and to talk about another hopeful thing that's in the book is you talk quite a lot about soil fertility and how important it is in helping avert climate change disasters that are upon us. And one of the things about sequestering carbon in the soil when you farm in an eco-friendly way is very, very hopeful. And I think that as more people grow their own food and use composting and compost tea and understand the microbiology of the soil, that's going to really help us. And you can talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I think soil is one of the most under-discussed elements of food. We don't really think about it too much. It's sort of just written off. Oh, it's just dirt. We don't have to worry about it too much. And I know there are some really great documentaries actually coming out on soil. So I think that's sort of like the next wave of food documentaries. There's a few about soil that are coming out. So I'm really excited about those. But I talk in the book about how, again, the fundamental base of a healthy farm is the healthy soil, and that organic farmers are all about how do you create healthy soil? How do you feed your soil? How do you make it so that it is a happy home for your plants? And what they discover is that in so doing, as you mentioned, you're sequestering carbon. There's some estimates out of the Rodale Institute that sequestering carbon in our soils, if we did it on a global scale, could cut emissions by 40%. I mean, that's staggering, and I don't think Rodale or I would believe that tomorrow we're going to convert all land to organic all around the world. But I think just that one statistic gives you a hint of how significant this could be. But the other thing that you see on organic farms, and I saw this as I visited organic farms, is that healthy soil, again, it's also more resilient soil. It's able to absorb more rainwater. So when you're deluged by the floods and deluged by the rains, that your farm can be resilient to that. So it's both has this mitigation aspect, but it also has this resilience aspect.
And when looking at the impact of food production on climate change, also, we really need to get out of the local community and go global. So we need to look at the big picture all around the world. And I think especially a lot of us locavore types tend to focus a lot on our local community only. But you've traveled extensively for the stories you tell in this book. And I was wondering, what are some of the highlights of your adventures out there?
Well, one of my one of the absolute life highlight was going to a food sovereignty summit in Mali. So food sovereignty, for those of you who haven't heard the term, it's used much more outside of the U.S. than here. But sovereignty, it sounds like a big, you know, complex idea, but essentially it's really, really simple. And essentially it means our ability to be able to have the power over our own food, to be able to decide what kind of food we grow, to decide what happens to that food that we grow. It's really about democratizing power over food. So I went to a food sovereignty summit that was organized by this radical organization of farmers and food producers from all around the world called La Via Campesina. And it was outside of the Mali, the capital of Mali, Bamako, in this this village that had been created as a convergence place for all of these food producers. And I went as an observer, and otherwise most of the people that were there were food producers. I was one of the few non-food producers there. So imagine being among 600 people from more than, I think it was more than 90 different countries who all had some connection to producing food. There was a shrimper from Louisiana, and there was an organic farmer from this mountainous region in Japan, and there was pastoralists from Iran, and there were women farmers from Kenya, and there were just, it was so incredible to be in this place with all these people who were directly connected to producing food and who spoke dozens and dozens of different languages. And a lot happened during that summit, but I think the thing that I carry with me the most from it was their core message, which is first that small scale farmers, that food producers, that they still exist in the world, that they still have a place in this modern world, and that they have, that what they do is honorable work and not something that we should all be moving away from. And secondly, what I got from them was their slogan for the time that we were together was that small scale farmers can feed the world and cool the planet. And essentially it goes back to that myth you talked about earlier, you know, can we feed the planet by going in this direction? Absolutely, absolutely. Not only can we do it, but it is the only way to feed the planet.
Well, thank you, Anna. We're going to take a short break and come back with both Anna and Louisa and have a conversation about the ways that you can make a difference in how you shop, cook, and eat.
Trouble, oh, trouble set me free. I have seen your face and it's too much for me. Trouble, oh, trouble, can't you see? You're eating my heart away and there's nothing much left of me. I drank your wine, you have made your world mine. So won't you be fair? So won't you be fair? So won't you be kind to me? Just let me go.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network. And this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. Louisa Shafia and Anna LePay are back with us now for more of a conversation about some guidelines we can follow to make healthier food choices for both ourselves and the planet. And Louisa, I'm so sorry. I keep massacring your name. And it's such a beautiful name. So,
hey, I gave you a really easy way to remember
it. Mafia Shafia. It's Louisa Shafia. And it's a gorgeous name. And again, I apologize.
Oh, that's okay.
So both of your books devote a lot of pages to really giving people some easy to remember and very practical tips and guidelines for making these choices. Anna has a chapter called Seven Principles to a Climate-Friendly Diet. And Luisa's, you have two areas besides the stories that you scatter through the recipes. You've got five habits for eco-friendly food shopping and a dozen ways to reduce waste. And I just found them very helpful. So I wondered if, Luisa, if you'd like to start us off.
Sure. Yeah, I had five sort of key things that I always like to keep in mind when I go shopping or when I sort of try to explain people my philosophy towards food shopping. The first one is shop local. I often have catering clients say, I want my event to be all organic. And I say, well, I love organics, but my priority is shopping local because, one, it's great to support small farmers. We want to preserve that kind of open space in our communities. We want to preserve those jobs in our local economies. And when you shop from a small local farmer, you know exactly what you're getting. Most of those farms you can go visit if you want to. But it, you know, if you don't want to go that far, you can ask the farmer lots of questions about, you know, what kind of practices they use on growing their food. And a lot of small farmers can't afford an organic certification. You know, even though they might be doing things all the right way, they just can't afford to jump through all those loopholes. So I feel like, hey, if it's from a local farmer, great.
And I'm just going to jump in just with one thing about that, because I get asked this a lot too. And a lot of things, you really need to look at where the regulations are coming from. And since the USDA took over the organic program, certification program, they're under a lot of pressure from lobbyists, from food groups and food industry lobbyists. And so you've got to keep a real vigilant watch on what do those standards really say, what do they mean, and read those standards, because they're in some ways have they've been diluted a bit, and there's always that potential for them to be diluted more. And so when a farmer tells you, well, we're beyond organic, they really know what they're talking about. So I just wanted to throw that.
Yeah, and I would jump in here too to say that at the moment, I completely agree with you, and at the same time, the USDA organic certification, it's what we've got here in this country in terms of ensuring the quality of our foods. Again, beyond just the local farmer at a farmer's market. And so I always say to people, look, this is goes back to why we can have these principles about what we should be eating. But there's sort of in mind, there's we have these seven principles of what to eat. And then there's the eighth principle, which is you got to go beyond your plate and you got to get active. You got to speak up and you've got to ensure that things like organic certification continues to mean something. And I know having a young daughter who I've just started to feed her solid foods, I've always been an organic food advocate, but talk about really being an advocate now that I think about what's going into her tiny little body and, you know, how much of a, when I look at like the proportion of her body to the banana she eats, you know, the banana's about the size of her entire arm, right? And I want that to be organic, or the broccoli she eats, or the brown rice, or whatever it is. So I haven't put anything in her body except organic. So I want us to be sure that we are really clear with people that organic certification, it's not written in stone. So it is definitely the potential for it to be diluted because of corporate pressures there. And there are these small scale farmers who can't afford to get that certification. And we absolutely, absolutely want to support them. And at the same time, we have the certification that does give us some assurance and let's ensure that that continues to mean something.
Yes, well, I'm laughing because my first rule is shop local, but my second is buy organic foods.
That's right.
Because it is very important. It is something that we have achieved because people really fought for it. And it really has become the gold standard. It's, you know, places like Walmart now have an organic food section. It is a huge achievement, and it's something we should keep supporting. But I would just advise people to pay attention to the organic label, you know, look at it closely. If you are trying to buy food for a baby or, you know, someone that has delicate health, you might sometimes look at the ingredient list and see that, oh, only a few of the ingredients are actually organic, or, you know, you might look and find that the product is something that was made halfway around the world.
That's right.
So it kind of is canceling itself out in terms of, hey, yeah, there were no pesticides used on it, but a whole lot of fossil fuels were used in getting it to you. So just think about it. Use your judgment.
Yeah, no, that's actually absolutely right. And I think that's where these principles and your tips here, Luisa, they're really complementary in the sense that they build off of each other. So that absolutely, you might see an organic you might see a product that has that organic seal on it, but if you look at where it was made, if it was made in China, you might think twice about whether you reach for that, or you wait till that Saturday to go to your farmer's market to get that same product from your farmer.
Or you even wait until the next season when it's available locally, because like an apple, I mean, you can get organic apples from New Zealand right now in Texas, but you can't get them locally till next fall. And you know, you just sometimes, as Louisa said earlier, it's kind of wonderful to wait for something, and then it's really delicious when you get it.
And I have to say, speaking of bananas, I also have kind of a, it's not a rant about bananas, but I give special attention to bananas in my book because I feel like that they're something that when I do go to the market with my list of, okay, the few things that I really want to be sure that they're organic, one of them is bananas. Because banana, the whole banana industry has a sort of a bad history in terms of labor practices, in terms of pesticide practices, and you know, just really polluting the land around them where they grow. So I go out of my way to get organic bananas when I can. However, this winter, I really tried to find some substitutes for bananas just in case I needed them. And I found that cooked squash makes a wonderful substitute for bananas in smoothies. So I just wanted to say that.
That's a great tip. And I can give you a tip for the baby alternative to bananas, because my daughter is a huge banana fan. But clearly, these are not local bananas, and but of course, what she really loves is how sweet they are. And so, I discovered her other favorite food, the really, really sweet food, is baking sweet potatoes. Not boiling them, not steaming them, because the sweetness isn't there, but baking them and getting them to that really deliciously melt in your mouth soft texture. She loved the sweet potatoes, and I was able to get, you know, get the sweet potatoes in there along with the bananas.
That is a great tip. Plus, I love the color of sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. I love cooking with them for that reason. Anyway, my next thing is to serve seasonal produce. I think it saves money. As I said, I think it's more fun to shop with the seasons because it means you get variety all through the year. And again, you get to buy from local farmers. And right now, a few of my favorite things, well, actually, Anna and I had dinner together last night, and I made a menu of seasonal things, and I got to use sorrel, which is, you know, that lemony tasting green. I used that in a soup. It actually grows wild. I didn't pick mine. I actually got mine at the farmer's market, but it was so fun to use it. I used garlic ramps, which are out right now. I actually saw lavender at our market for the first time since the winter, so I got to make a pear crisp with a lavender cream, and it was just so fun. It's all ingredients that I hadn't been able to use for the last several months, and
it was also ridiculously delicious. So, but what I loved last night, we had this dinner, and the guests were just oohing and aahing about how amazing everything was and asking Louisa about her process. And I loved what you said, which was that you kind of had an idea of what you wanted to do for the dinner. But then once you got to, you went to a farm that had a farm stand, and once you got to the farm stand, then you started kind of playing around with, okay, well, so they have this, but they didn't have that. But instead of staying really rigid to the fixed idea you had about exactly what you were going to cook, you kind of let yourself be moved in different directions. And you know, for folks like me that aren't quite as gifted in the kitchen as you, that might be a little bit more challenging. But speaking from experience, you can still, even for those beginner cooks like me, you know, you can still be also led by what you're finding at the market.
And Louisa's book is a great way to start too, if you're not that experienced, because she kind of leads you through the process in the book.
Oh, well, you know, that actually brings up a great point in terms of being flexible with your menu. Also, even with a recipe, you know, I feel like I want people to know recipes are not biblical. If you see a recipe and you like it, but you don't have all the ingredients, you know, say it calls for squash and you only have sweet potatoes around, hey, make it. If it calls for thyme and you only have oregano, try it anyway. It will probably come out fabulously. You know, so definitely feel free with the recipes in my cookbook and any book that you look at to, you know, make them your own. I'll just bring up my last two points as some of my most important rules that I try and follow, and that is to choose eco-friendly fish. That's become a very important thing for me in the last couple of years. I love fish. I feel like it's really important for my diet. But there are so many bad things coming out in the news about the way that fish are farmed in you know, these aquaculture setups, and then also about many, many of the most popular species of fish becoming extinct because we overfish them. And again, I am generally turning to the farmer's market to see what's local, what wonderful fish we have around. Also, there are a couple of really great online resources. There's the Monterey Bay Aquarium, has a wonderful seafood list. You can, you know, check which are the most recommended, you know, in terms of being low on mercury, in terms of being safe, in terms of their level of population. Also, the Natural Resources Defense Council on their website has a great seafood watch list. So I like to look at those even before I go out to eat, just so I can make a conscious, informed choice about what seafood I get.
And that Monterey Bay seafood watch list, you can go onto their site, you can download it and put it in. It's like a pocket guide in your wallet. And I remember on one of the very first dates with the man who became my husband, we were ordering and he pulled out his pocket guide and I thought it was really hot.
Oh, yes. You knew he was a keeper.
Hot and sexy.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And you kind of, you know, sometimes you have to be bold and speak up and ask in a restaurant, well, where did that come from? Or when you're shopping for food, I often do it. And it can be awkward. A lot of times people don't know where it came from. But I feel like it makes a real start. They will go ask their manager, you know, people have been asking where the fish comes from, and they'll change it. And I noticed, you know, these days at one of the big national natural grocery stores, they now say where all the fish and seafood comes from on a sign. So, you know, it really makes an impact over time.
Definitely.
Okay, last but not least, eat less meat. And when you do eat meat, buy responsibly. So basically the same thing as the seafood. You know, look for grass-fed beef. Look for meat that comes from small farmers that does not have hormones or additives. Also, here in the U.S., we eat a lot more meat than we really need to, on average, per person. And if you're concerned about, you know, grass-fed meat costs a whole lot more, use less of it in your diet and choose the stuff that's really good quality.
That's one of my favorite tips, because I think that a lot of people have eliminated meat from their diet because, and rightly so, because of the way that it's commercially and industrialized, how it's produced in most of the meat that we eat out in restaurants and most of the meat in the supermarkets is not responsibly raised or sustainably raised. And yet meat is a good protein when it's, and especially when it's raised on pasture. So, and with animal welfare concerns as well, both. I think it's very important to know that. And the best way to find those meats are at the farmer's market.
Yep, exactly.
Anna, you want to talk a little bit about some of your principles?
Sure. And what I found in developing these principles for a climate-friendly diet is that so many of the principles that Louisa just shared, the principles that probably many of you listening to this might have picked up from maybe your exposure to Marianne Nessel and her work, or Michael Pollan or Alice Waters, or you know, the people who've been writing and talking about the importance of eating local foods, eating whole foods, eating food that's healthy for our bodies. What you find is that those same principles really apply to the choices you can make to have a lower carbon footprint. So to think about what are the ways to reduce your emissions that come out of your diet, following those principles, you'll also be essentially eating a low carbon diet. And that's because of all the ways in which I mentioned earlier, this industrial food chain contributes so much to emissions. So the more that you're pulling yourself out of the industrial system and putting yourself into the local sustainable food chain, the more that you're going to be reducing your emissions. And the more that you decrease the distance between yourself and where your food came from, the more you're going to be reducing your emissions. And, you know, this doesn't mean entirely cutting out all the food that comes from outside of our borders. It just means being curious enough to ask the story behind the food, and to also figure out ways, again, to decrease the steps between you and your food producer. So, for instance, you know, I, having written this book, obviously care about food, care about where it comes from, care about its impact on the environment, but I also really love coffee. So does that mean I have to give up coffee? Well, I have not given up coffee. So what has been my solution has been to find a way for me to know how my coffee was produced, know those coffee producers, and know that the distance between myself and that production is as close as possible, that there's as close of a link as possible. So I support this really great company that imports coffee. It's called Crop to Cup, and that's where we get all of our coffee now, and it feels like I have this direct connection to producers, and I know, have this assurance about how that coffee was produced.
And you can also, you know, seek out local coffee roasters, and that way you're still supporting a local food business in your community.
That's exactly right. And in the book I talk about, as I mentioned, these seven principles about what we can do as eaters, but in the last chapter I talk about this, effectively my eighth principle, or going beyond your fork, where I say, look, we have these choices that we can make every single day when we eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and any of the other snacks we might choose. Those are choices we can make as eaters. And then there's a whole host of choices we can make, action we can take, things that we can do beyond our plate. And one of those actions we can take is essentially to speak up for the need to have a new vision for what the future of food should look like and what kind of infrastructure we need to have that future of food. So I think there's been a very public, very robust conversation about the need to build new wind power and solar power and this new infrastructure we need for green energy. I think we're sort of getting that out there. That's in the public conversation. But where is the public conversation about the food infrastructure we'd need to have the food for this century? And that kind of infrastructure is things like, where are the slaughterhouses that we're going to have for those local producers to be able to actually sell to a local market and have their production be local? Where are the distribution channels to have those upstate apple growers and the upstate lettuce growers bringing that food into Manhattan to feed those people living in the city? So yes, there's these principles we can take as eaters, but then it's what can we speak up for as citizens, and what is the kind of infrastructure we should be fighting for and calling for that would really help us continue to feed ourselves into the century and beyond.
And a lot of that is with policymaking as well. So I'm just going to put a quick plug in for April 11th in the Austin area, Austin, Texas. There's a farm tour on the east side of Austin, visiting five or six urban farms now that we have on the east side of Austin. And it's a benefit for the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. And you can go to farmandranchfreedom.org. They're a national lobby group for a lot of what Anna and Luis have been talking about, to try to help lobby on a policy level with the government. So, and Anna, you have the Small Planet Fund, and I know if any, all our listeners should go to annalapay.com, and you can find out more about the Small Planet Fund and also where she'll be on her upcoming book tour, which I think is kicking off tomorrow.
Yes. Well, we had our East Coast launch on Thursday. We're kicking off with our West Coast launch. And what's exciting about the tour to me is that it's fun to get out there talking about the book, but what's really fun to see is all of the stuff that's happening on the ground in cities all across this country. And so this tour, unlike any other tour I've done, I'm actually partnering with a lot of city governments, with local government, who are saying, look, we don't want to wait for change to happen on the international climate change policy level. We want to make change happen today, right now. We want to get to work, and we're going to get to work on all kinds of things, including food policy that's about creating greener food policy and more local food policy that supports local farmers and beekeeping and all kinds of great things.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much to our guests today, Luisa Shafia and Anna LaPay. And thank you all for listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network. If you'd like a free copy of Luisa's book or Anna's book, just email me some of your favorite eco tips. And we'll put those online on edibleaustin.com. I'll be back on Monday, May 3rd for our next Taproots show. And I look forward to hearing from you in the meantime. Email me at marla@edibleaustin.com. And we'll talk to you next time.